Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our LTS seminar series for 2022. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about what LTS is, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about our LTS seminar series, and then I'm going to introduce our speaker for this evening. So a little sort of three-part process that I'm doing here. I suppose actually I should introduce myself first for those who don't know me. So I'm Professor Andrew Murray from the LSE. That's why it says LSE behind me on my backdrop. So who is the LTS? So the Law, Technology and Society Group, the LTS, is in the LSE Law School, and it's our home for a really top-notch, I think, research group that conducts world-leading research in areas around technology and its normative implications, including the legal, regulatory, and social implications of emerging technologies such as AI, ICT, blockchain, biotech, distributed systems, and fintech, regtech, and lawtech. We're a small, but well, we're not that small. We're a reasonably sized and growing group, and we're trying to be an interface between academia, legal practice, and the people who are working in the policy sphere in this area, in Westminster and beyond. So we're trying to bring these three audiences together, and that's part of the reason behind the seminar series that you should hopefully all be seeing on your screens at the moment. So the seminar series is part of our communications model to get our research and thoughts out there. We invite along eminent guest speakers to come and talk about areas of interest to the LTS group and to our sort of wider community. And this year we have four seminars based around the legal challenges of AI, the first of which I'm just about to introduce. You can see the others. So these are some diary dates for you going forward. We've got one on the 8th of March with Jeremias Adams-Pressel about AI in the workplace. And for those of you at LSE, that will be hybrid, we hope. So LSE staff and students will be able to attend in person. Unfortunately, under LSE's current COVID rules, if you're not a currently enrolled LSE student or member of staff, you will have to join remotely. We'll be circulating registration details for that very soon. And then we have a double header. We've got two from Emmanuel Mbabzi and Sebastian Helensbellen. Sorry, I just murdered his name. I apologize to Sebastian. Looking at the AI Act and also looking at how machine learning processes work. So Emmanuel is actually a data scientist. He works in AI large data sets and training machine learning. And his seminar is designed to train lawyers to understand how computer scientists train large data set ML and to show some of the risks and biases that can occur in the training of large data set ML. And on the next night, he will be joined by his colleague, Sebastian, who Emmanuel and Sebastian were very instrumental in drafting the AI Act, the European AI Act, and they will talk about why the AI Act is drafted the way it is and the challenges it aims to meet. Emmanuel's seminar, if you'd seen an earlier circulation, was originally on the 22nd of February. That has been moved because of potential UCU strike dates. So these are the new dates. So that is forthcoming. I see already in the chat a question, is it an LTS Twitter account? No, there is not. And there is not even a hashtag that I've thought of yet. You could, Chris, use LTS AI. Why not? Or make one up. There you go. It's not too barbarian. You can make one up. But I've not yet set one up or thought about one. And we don't have a Twitter account because I believe if you don't keep Twitter accounts alive, they die. So we are just using our own personal accounts at the moment. Okay, that's enough for me. You're not here to hear me. I'm going to stop sharing screen because you're here for the main event, and the main event is not me. The main event tonight is Professor Roger Brownsword, who is going to be talking about law regulation in AI, the many governance questions. Now, Roger doesn't really need an introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway, even though he doesn't need it. All you really need to know about Roger is if you go to his page at King's College London, the first line says, Professor Roger Brownsword is a graduate of the LSE. So you can see very clearly what Roger thinks is the most important part of his biography, and who am I to disagree? But he's an academic lawyer whose career spans some 50 years. And I think he's been a groundbreaking lawyer in areas around biotech, around other areas of technology application, and particularly at the moment, he's looking at things around the regulation of emerging technologies. He's got a new book coming out. I'll plug your book for you, Roger. He's got a new book coming out in March called Rethinking Law, Regulation and Technology in the excellent Rethinking series. I could also plug another excellent book in that series by Chris Reed and Andrew Murray. And it's really looking at a relationship between law, regulation and technology, and the tools that we can use to regulate emergent and new technologies. I am very lucky in that I've already read the book. I managed to get an advanced copy, and it's phenomenal. It's absolutely excellent. And I said in my little bit of blurb that they could put on the back cover that it's a genuine must read. And I don't say that very often. It's a real book that makes a key contribution. So Roger is a leading thinker. We're very honored to have him kick off our 2022 seminar series. I am now going to stop talking. Roger is going to talk for about 40 to 45 minutes or so is the aim. If anyone has questions that come to them as Roger is speaking, you can pop them in the chat. You can either pop them in the general chat or you can send them to me as a direct message in the chat and I will hold on to them. And then when we come to the end of Roger's address, shall we say, Roger's speech, then there will be a chance for questions. And at that point, if you want to, we can use the raise hand function that's built into Zoom, or you can, again, put questions in the chat. So we'll let Roger speak. Don't interrupt him while he's speaking. We can collect questions in the chat. And then at the end, we will throw all the excellent questions you have at Roger. So I am now going to stop talking. I'm going to mute myself so nobody can hear me if I do say anything. And I'm going to hand over the floor to Roger.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be giving this talk. And the talk, as you know, is about law, regulation and AI and the many governance questions. And the emphasis here is on the many governance questions and how we might kind of organize and order those questions a little bit. Now, Andrew mentioned that in my bio, the LSE figures very prominently at the top of it. And yeah, I mean, it was a life-changing moment for me going to LSE. But one of the first things I did as I arrived back in 1965 for my undergraduate law program at LSE was buy a job lot of books from a second year student who no longer required those books. He assured me that this was all I needed. And it was literally a suitcase full of books that he handed over to me. Now, when I got back to base with this suitcase of books, I did know roughly which books went where, so to speak, on the bookshelf, because I knew that we were studying constitutional law, contracts, legal system and economics. So that great big Sam Wilson economics book, I knew which part of the bookshelf that was going on. And then there was, you know, Stanley De Smith's book on constitutional law, and there was Smith and Thomas's case book on contract. I could see, yeah, where these books went. But if you imagine that I was now to try to organize, or you were trying to organize a job lot of books about law, regulation, and AI, you could say, well, okay, these are all in a general way to do with law, regulation, and AI, but how can we kind of subdivide or classify these books to organize the kind of questions that they're asking? I'm more about organizing the questions, seeing where they lie in relation to one another. And hopefully we'll begin to see then the wood for the trees and what the really big questions are and what aren't quite such big questions. Although I shan't be able to complete that part of the exercise today, but at least begin the organization of it. Okay, so I'm looking through my job lot of AI books and law books, regulation of AI. And I mean, a starting point might be to try and look through for the, what I call, I don't say this in any disparaging way at all, kind of trade books, which, you know, fantastic background reading for those of us who are trying to get into this field. So I'm thinking about books like Cathy O'Neill's Weapons of Mass Destruction, Frank Pascal's Black Box Society, Virginia Eubanks, Automating Inequality. These are great books, fantastic reads, and full of stories that engage your attention. Now, I mean, those three that I've mentioned are books which sound cautionary notes about AI. AI might have great promise, the prospectus might look wonderful, but the performance of AI, yeah, you know, there are questions to be asked, so we need to be careful. And if your question is, do we really need to have any governance of AI? The books I've mentioned already would say, yes, we do. But of course, there are books that give a more upbeat account of it and full of the promise. And so if you take that seriously as well, these trade books, some of which are more positive than others about AI, would kind of generate what I think is the standard conundrum for people who work in the field of law, regulation, and technology, which is, how can we put in place a regulatory environment which incentivizes and supports innovation here of AI, machine learning, or whatever, which we think is going to be beneficial? And how, at the same time, can we make sure that we manage the risks in a way that is acceptable, you know, and respects the fundamental values of our communities? How can we do all that? Which, of course, is what the EU's AI Act is exactly what it's trying to do. Encourage and support innovation in Europe and try and take advantages of these developments, but at the same time, make sure that people aren't exposed to unacceptable risks or they compromise the values to which they are committed regionally or nationally. So trade books I can put over there, that's fine. Now, when I turn to the more academic titles, how about those? Well, there are a number of academic books which seem to originate from workshops or conferences, you know, where a group of academics have got together and then someone's edited up the papers. Martin Ebbers is a guy who's done quite a few of these, and one of Martin's books, a collection of essays, which he co-edited with Marta Camito, has a title which I think could be very helpful. I mean, it's not the sharpest, like the catchiest title, but it's a title that, you know, tells you what's in the tin, and it's Algorithmic Governance and Governance of Algorithms. Algorithmic Governance and Governance of Algorithms. That's the title. So it suggests that there are two things going on in this book, as indeed there are, that some of the essays in the book, some of the chapters are about algorithmic governance, meaning governance by algorithms. And some of the essays in there are about the governance of algorithms. So, you know, we can pivot from thinking about algorithms as tools, instruments for governance, and we can think about them as something that needs to be governed. Now the next book of a collection of essays is co-edited by Karen Young and Martin Lodge. So it's an LSE connection. And in fact, I was involved in some of the early stages of that collection, and they were held on the LSE's premises, those seminars. And this is a book that has the title Algorithmic Regulation and Algorithmic Regulation. Now, many years ago, I co-edited a book with Karen that we called Regulating Technologies. And some people pointed out to us that this title was ambivalent. Were we talking about the regulation of technologies, or was this a book about technologies that had regulatory effects or could be used for regulatory purposes? To which the answer was, yeah, it is by design ambivalent. It's meant to open up both those conversations. Let's talk about both sides of that. And sure enough, algorithmic regulation, just like Martin Ebbers and Marta Gamita's book, has both dimensions to it. It's predominantly, in Karen and Martin's case, I think, about using algorithms for governance purposes. But, you know, there's stuff in there as well about the regulatory frameworks for AI. Now, a third collection of essays, which I ought to know something about, because I contributed one of the essays in this one, is by edited by Simon Deakin and Chris Marco, and this is Law Computable? Well, I can tell you that those of us who contributed to that collection were encouraged to direct our attention to engage with Ben Allery's work. Particularly one of the articles in which Ben Allery talks about the way in which AI could be used as a tool to give people a steer on what were quite a tricky legal question. The example that Ben Allery uses in his article is about a client or someone who wants to know their legal position in relation to people who work for them. Are these workers people who are employees in the legal sense, or are they merely acting as independent contractors? And the law, distinction between employees and independent contractors, as we know from the platform cases, but we've known for a long time, is a problematic distinction. And the law changes its sort of paradigm from time to time. And I'd say that in general, these cases are very fact specific. Knowing how they're going to come out depends very much on the particular facts of the case. Humans who are advising on this would always, my father-in-law used to always say that whenever he went to lawyers he was a company secretary, whenever he went to lawyers for advice, it was this two hands job. He was always on the one hand this, on the other hand that. And you can imagine that in relation to the question, is this an independent contractor or an employee? You might get a kind of answer like that. It's a really hard case. But maybe the AI, could do a better job on this and read the case law in a way that's more penetrating and more predictive. And Allery, of course, then is saying, if you can do this, well, AI can do other things in, not just advise. It could go on to become a decision maker in its own right. And, civil cases could be going before AI judges, so to speak. The question was, well, what do we make of that? But that's a question which is very much about governance by algorithms. That's very much in that genre, governance by algorithms. It's not so much about putting in place a regulatory or a legal framework for the applications of AI in health or transport or wherever. It's about, AI being deployed for legal and regulatory functions as a tool. Okay, now, there are, of course, monographs too, and just a couple to mention. The most recent one that I've read, anyway, was by Simon Chesterman, We the Robots, great book. Andrew's kindly given me a plug for my forthcoming book. This one by Simon Chesterman is a great book too. Well, I shouldn't say too, it's a great book, I should say. Yeah. But it starts in a slightly unusual way, because it doesn't sort of announce at the start, oh, I'm going to be talking about the regulation of AI or AI as a regulatory tool. It doesn't give you a steer on that. It starts off by highlighting three specific features of AI, which Simon Chesterman takes as being the cues for thinking about regulation. It's been unusual for people in law and technology to start in that way. Although when there was a period when nanotechnology was in the spotlight, people generally started then with, well, nanotechnology, we're talking about, it's about size, it's about, a very nano scale. It's, you've got to get your head around that before you can begin to think about the regulation of nanotechnologies. But Simon Chesterman says, well, look, the three things that stand out here that are striking about AI are, first of all, speed, the speed at which it operates. Secondly, opacity, lack of transparency is okay. And thirdly, the degree of autonomy that AI has. And it's not just that these are three characteristics. These are characteristics which, unless we try to retard or interfere in a regulatory way, these are going to become more prominent. In other words, the direction of travel with AI is going to be, it's going to get quicker. It's going to get more opaque as we go deeper into, I suppose, deep learning and machine learning. It's going to get more opaque. And it's going to get, insofar as you think about different levels of autonomy, like with autonomous vehicles, it's going to, it's going to be getting to the top of those scales. Now, the question is what from a regulatory perspective do we need to do about this? Simon's response is, in many ways, we've already got these things covered because we've got existing. It's not like we're starting from scratch. We do have a lot of law out there already. And a lot of it can be deployed in ways that will cover our concerns. But, I don't think he's suggesting we can arrest these developments, or and sooner or later we might have to face these questions, like whether AI should be accorded legal personality or granted rights or whatever, you know. So this book turns out to be in the genre of getting the regulatory environment in shape for AI. It's not about governance by algorithms or by AI. It's about the governance of rule frameworks, rules and principles, which can be deployed as the regulatory or governance framework for AI. And the same is true of the final book I'll mention in this, just this initial tour around some literature, which is Ryan Abbott's book, The Reasonable Robot. And this is a very entertaining book, which Ryan starts off in a very provocative way, because he advances, I think he calls it the neutrality principle, but it's a kind of default principle for regulators, which says that if you are now using AI tools to do tasks, to perform functions, which have either been performed by humans previously or could have been, then you should treat the AI or the robot, AI-enabled robots, exactly as if they were humans. And he starts with a compelling chapter about tax, where even an employer gets rid of human employees and replaces them with robots, then this shouldn't make any difference to the tax take that the state gets from this employer. You shouldn't be a way of cutting back on your tax liabilities by bringing robots on instead of humans. But Ryan's real agenda, I think, is to do with how we should view AI tools that are being deployed to do inventive work and potentially patentable work, or to do creative work and copyrightable work. How does he, how does that work in IP? Of course, that he's going around, well, he's been already to the English Court of Appeal to test that point out in relation to whether an AI tool that was used by a human to do some inventive work which was patentable, whether the AI could be regarded as the inventor within the English patent law or the originator of the invention. If you applied the neutrality principle, as your default, then you'd say, well, why not? Again, that though is in the same genre, I think, as the Chesterman book. It's about getting the regulatory environment right for these for AI in this case, and about the governance regime for AI. So at the end of this, I find that my organization of the books, well, I've got the trade books over here, then the academic books, I've basically got in three categories. I've got books which seem to be focusing on governance by algorithms, using algorithms for governance purposes. And then at the other end, I've got books which aren't about that, but are about, the regulatory framework or the legal framework that we wrap around AI, and the ground rules for the use and application of AI. And then we have books in the middle which can pivot either way, which have both dimensions of this in play. Okay, and that'd be a starting point for ordering the books. And no doubt, having got that far, if that's a reasonable bet, we could train some AI then to do the further classification of the future for us, so that as new books come in, we wouldn't need to trouble ourselves where they went on that shelf. The AI would sort it all out for us and tell us where to put them. Okay, just a bit like sort of Netflix. Making recommendations that the way you should be putting this book on your bookshelf. Okay, now I'm going to take this from here in four steps. And so first of all, I'm going to stepping back from this, I'm going to talk about how lawyers do and have engaged with emerging technologies and identify three distinct modes of engagement. And then secondly, I'm going to ask you to imagine a conference which is about law and AI, which is set up explicitly to reflect these three modes of engagement, so that the conference organizers are saying we'll have three streams at this conference, three kind of conversations, each of which reflects these three modes of engagement, which I'll be sketching for you in a minute. And then thirdly, I'll be identifying what I think are some additional questions, like a fourth stream, residual or miscellaneous, which don't fit into any of the three streams that we've got at the conference, at this imaginary conference, but where there are some important questions for the future lining up. And finally, I'll just have a few words about where that takes us, because it's going to reveal some major concerns I have about governance and respect for those who govern, Well, reflections too about how an AI law might fit into that. Okay, so to start with the first of these four steps, the first step is to identify three ways in which lawyers engage with new technologies. When I arrived at the LSE back in 1965, to go back to that starting point, because this is the kind of baseline, that actually in the earlier part of the 1960s had been quite a lot of talk about the white heat of technology. And Harold Wilson had given a famous speech, I think it was in Scarborough, at a Labour Party conference somewhere in the early 60s, when he went on about the white heat of technology. And this had kind of found its way into the political discourse. But the law school wasn't encouraging its students to go out and think about technology. I mean, we had to do some economics because I think, you know, it was a philosophy of the LSE that no one who graduated from there should be completely illiterate in relation to economics. But I don't think the economics was really meant to inform our understanding of law. You know, I don't think it was thought, although of course law and economics was to become a huge thing. I don't think at that time really the thinking was that, oh, well, you know, if you can think like a law and economics person, you'll be a better kind of lawyer. No, I mean, thinking like a lawyer was a very inward-looking process that, you know, it was necessary to train people to think like lawyers, young people, like, you know, that you had to shut out all the other noise. That meant all the other noise within the academy. I mean, Andrew's talking here about, you know, this particular set of seminars cutting across disciplines and engaging with other disciplines. Well, you know, the idea that lawyers should be talking to people in philosophy or sociology, you know, that wasn't really on the agenda at that time. So it wasn't on the agenda at all that we should be thinking about technology. You know, what do you think about law and technology? Well, I'm trying to think about law. You know, leave technologists to worry about technology would be sort of response to that. I don't think it was the law school was anti-technology, nothing like that. It was just, you know, this, I think in all law schools at the time, the thinking, the pedagogic thinking was that teaching young people to think like lawyers was quite a learning curve. And they didn't need to be thinking about anything else at the time. You know, even, you know, the famous common lawyer, Carl Llewellyn, when he was giving his introductory lectures at Columbia to his students in the 1920s, I think, you know, he said, you need to knock your ethics into a state of temporary anesthesia, meaning, you know, leave behind those sort of ethical intuitions that you have. We in the law school, we just focus on the application of law. And you know, some of the applications are easy, some of them are much more tricky, and we meet novel situations. And in some of those situations, some technologies might be involved, but you know, it's no big deal, nothing special. Technology is not salient or significant if you're viewing it from the perspective of thinking like a lawyer. So the first mode of engagement is that, okay, we'll apply our legal principles, our legal templates, you know, our classifications and concepts to these situations where technology appears. But, you know, we don't need to get fazed by the fact that technology's on the radar here. We'll just carry on as though it was anything, you know, whether it's technology or not. We're just going to apply our principles. They're very flexible. We can do all sorts of things with them. And that's what we're going to do. That's the first mode of engagement. Now, the second mode of engagement is very different. Now, here, technology is seen as being both salient and significant. And in my lifetime, although I carried on in mode one from the time I graduated right through to the early 1990s, just by accident, really, in the 1990s, I found myself getting involved in both thinking about developments in biotech, in genetics especially, and, of course, what was going on with the development of the internet and e-commerce. As a contract lawyer, you know, I was thinking about that. So there were two huge developments in technology going on in genetics and in information technology at the time, which were coming onto my radar. And the thought was, well, of course, this was exciting and interesting, but it was challenging. You know, the relationship between law and technology was a challenge for law. And it was challenging in two ways. I mean, one way was biotech highlighted this, that what was going on in genetics was bringing to the surface ethical divisions in Europe that we just hadn't realized, you know, were there. I mean, in 1990, the beginning of that decade, the Human Fertilization Embryology Act was enacted, but it took 6 years from the delivery of the Warnock Committee's report in 1984 before Parliament signed off that piece of legislation. And it wasn't because the parliamentarians were really worried about IVF. you know, assessed at conception. I think they got the measure of that. But it was the fact that surplus human embryos from IVF could be made available to researchers for their embryology research. And, you know, a lot of people were jibbing at that. They didn't like the idea that, you know, even with a 14-day limit, that researchers should be able to use human embryos for research purposes. That wasn't respectful of human life. But things were going to get a lot worse. You know, things were going to get a lot more complex as the human genome was getting sequenced, and we're beginning to see something about the interpretability of genetic markers. So the questions about legitimacy and taking a defensible position that were going to be problematic, at the same time, the development of the internet. Well, in 1996, David Johnson and David Post wrote an absolutely seminal article in the Stanford Law Review in which they warned us that cyberspace doesn't map neatly onto land-based legal systems and that this was going to be problematic. I mean, you might have thought, oh, well, this is just going to be a problem for conflicts lawyers who aren't going to be able to figure out which jurisdiction is, you know, where the jurisdiction lies or which is applicable law. But it was much more serious than that, because at the same time, John Perry Barlow in 1996 was penning his famous Declaration of Independence, where he was laying down, you know, a challenge to nation states saying, you know, cyberspace, well, that's not your territory. You don't own that. You don't have, you know, your sovereignty doesn't extend there. Why should we take any notice of the rules that you nation states are laying down for cyberspace? And I imagine that conversation is going to be repeated in relation to the metaverse, where, you know, new spaces, new options, and people say, well, how come land-based law applies here? The question of how national lawmakers and regulators would be able to hold the line on positions they wanted to take up when e-commerce was going to deliver a cyber market where people could order online all sorts of goods and services, very difficult indeed for nation states to close their borders to that and control what was going on. So there were questions about legitimacy and effectiveness. And, that in mode two, I would say that those who are thinking, well, yeah, we lawyers have to attend to technology, but it's problematic. It's a challenge for us. You know, we want to get the regulatory environment right. We need to make sure that the laws we have, the rules we have, are fit for purpose. But dealing with technology, that is not pushing an open door. That is a major challenge. Now, the third mode of engagement is a kind of extension of this, but it flips the thing, because now we're still thinking in a regulatory way, thinking about whether the law and its rules are fit for purpose. But the twist now is that we view technology, well, of course, it's still a challenge, but there are many respects in which technology might be part of the solution. So we now, in the third mode of engagement, are seeing the opportunity to employ tools that these technologies deliver up to us as responses to some of the regulatory problems we have. So they're already, you know, back then, DNA profiling was seen as an important tool for use in the criminal justice system. But of course, the seminal moment was when Lawrence Lessig talked about CODA's law and architecture and all that, you know, and all of a sudden you see that there are non-rule or non-principle, non-standards responses that might be employed for regulatory purposes. And technology is part of that kit. So to summarize, we have three modes of engagement there that lawyers either just deny that technology is salient or significant, and thinking like a lawyer is just applying usual legal principles, business as usual, even if technology is on the radar. Then you've got lawyers who do recognize that technology is salient and significant, but see it as a challenge, as a problem. And then you've got, in the third mode, lawyers who also recognize technology is salient and significant, but see it as a potential solution. A technical fix might be what we need to do. Now, if you ask within these three modes of thinking, do we need an AI law? I think the first group, first way of thinking, would say, well, no, why should we need AI law? You know, we've got all the stuff we need already in the repertoire. A bit like Warren and Brandeis back in the 1890s. You know, so, well, yeah, we've got a problem here created by these new photography there. The uses are unacceptable. We need to do something about it, but we can fix it. We don't need to trouble the legislature. We can fix it without that. We can developed the idea of a right to privacy from within the common law resources. And this idea, we don't need to trouble the legislature. We've got our principles, we've got flexible rules. We can do quite a lot with property and contracts and torts and so on. But the other two modes of thinking, the second and the third, which are regulatory modes, do we need an AI law? Yeah, I think, the second mode of thinking is saying, yeah, we need to have a law that lays down the ground rules for the application of AI, and it's going to be challenging. And the third mode is thinking, AI could be a very important tool to be deployed in various ways to perform legal and regulatory functions. Let's think about that. Yeah. But we need some governance there too. We need an AI law. Now then, the second stage is to imagine, I ask you to imagine that a conference is being set up with three streams, and the three streams are supposed to reflect those three modes of thought I've just described. What sort of conversations and what sort of lawyers will we expect to be going along? So in the first stream is the sort of mode one or law 1.0 way of thinking, where, these people don't regard technology as anything special. It's there on the radar, but it's just about applying legal principles to it. So, tort lawyers will be there talking about how they're going to try and apply fault-based liability or causation, ideas of causation and reasonable care to autonomous vehicles. Yeah, and we're interested to hear how they're going to do that, or how they're going to apply fault-based principles to negligence, negligence principles to accidents or things that go wrong in hospital settings or at work, the usual places where tort claims might arise. How are we going to do that? How do these principles apply? Some contract lawyers might be there too, that it's already sort of high frequency trading where algorithms are being employed, and we think we can manage that. But contract lawyers are sort of a bit busy at the moment as well, thinking more about smart contracts and blockchain, and where you find the fiat contracts in these settings where these technologies are being deployed to do some of the transactional performance. Now, property lawyers are very interested generally in figuring out how to employ the concept of property, which things are property type things and their classificatory schemes. But they are focused at the moment again on the crypto world. How do property concepts and classifications map onto crypto assets is a burning question. You might have some criminal lawyers there saying, yeah, well, in core crime, we think about mens rea and actus reus. And it's an interesting little puzzle here about how we might apply mens rea to evil AI that commit, where the actus reus looks like a criminal offence. Yeah. So you get quite a few, particularly private lawyers, I think, going along to that first stream. Then the second stream, which is where we're thinking about getting the regulatory environment right and asking whether our rules are fit for purpose. I would expect that to be the biggest and the most popular stream, because if you look at across the whole body of work going on in the field, I think most of it is in this genre. I've already mentioned, for example, in Ryan Abbott's book, the questions about how IP might play in relation to work being done by inventive work, creative work being done by AI tools. but there's many questions too about how protective regulatory regimes that we have at the moment work in relation to consumers or data subjects or employees, vulnerable people, children, students. I mean, how does it work where AI is being applied in those contexts? Are the protections that we have already got in place for these people, for these classes of person, are they being compromised by AI? Are we going around them? And of course, it's a huge amount of concern, isn't there, about from people like Julie Cohen and Shoshana Zuboff in again very, very widely debated books, where they see information or surveillance capitalism, bringing together concerns that we have about data subjects and consumers. So much data is being harvested from consumers just in ordinary consumption, and then being not just played through the markets in the background, but being used in ways which not only, well, not only are able to predict where consumers might, where you might attract consumers' attention, or you might get a click for a purchase, but in Shoshana Zuboff's analysis, of course, you know, going beyond that to ultimately be able to control the choices that consumers make, and you know, quite dystopian sort of picture in coming out from that. So I think there'll be a lot of discussion about this, about AI being used in workplaces, or you know, in educational establishments and elsewhere. And although there's a lot of talk about the regulatory framework for autonomous vehicles, where we wouldn't be, of course, just thinking about fault-based liability. We'd be looking at there, you'd be surveying the full range of options for compensation. But in various capacities, I've read quite a lot of work actually from maritime lawyers who are really working hard to see how international maritime regulation, which presupposes that you've got a human master on board a vessel, or at least somewhere human on shore who's controlling the vessel, you know, what happens where they drop out of the picture? Very interesting stuff, you know. And there's plenty of work to be done there. And then the third stream is the stream where we're now thinking about, as in Simon Deakin and Chris Marcus, but we're thinking about how far we're prepared to go with AI or other tools that are being used to perform legal and regulatory functions. And in the criminal justice system, of course, you know, we have already some of the most well-publicized examples of AI being incorporated into, like, policing practice, for example, or also into decision-making along the track in criminal justice, where, you know, decisions about bail or about punishment or about parole are being made by humans who are assisted by AI tools. Of course, the famous Loomis case in Wisconsin insists that decision makers in the criminal justice system mustn't simply rely on the AI tools indication of whether, like, you know, it's a high risk person, so a certain sort of recommendation follows. But how far, you know, obviously how far human decision makers can distance themselves from recommendations made by those tools is a burning issue. But one of the things you notice about this is that a lot of the discussion in relation to criminal justice and AI is kind of ex post, which is about how AI might be employed as a tool once the crime's been committed. But I think the more significant thing is about the way in which AI might be, or other tools might be employed in an ex ante way to prevent crime. Now, almost all our jurisprudence and thinking about criminal justice is, you know, about the justification for punishment and due process and so on. It's almost all in an ex post context. You know, a crime's being committed, and now what are the police entitled to do? What are the prosecution entitled to do? How's the trial to be set up? What sort of safeguards are there for the defendant? And what kind of punishments can be justified? It's all ex post. But these tools put the state in a position to try to anticipate crime and anticipate, you know, who are high risk. And there's a real, I mean, Andrew Ashworth, who was my, we were in digs together as students at the LSE. And so that suitcase full of books that I mentioned at the beginning was a suitcase of books that Andrew, and I can't actually remember, to be very honest, whether Andrew might have arranged a deal on that. I can't remember, but it was quite a smart deal anyway, but whichever, he was far more streetwise than I was at that stage in terms of the book buying. Andrew and Lucia said that, you know, they have a great book on preventive justice. And, you know, the question is how far do the human rights and liberal values that we want to bring into criminal justice design through due process gateway, how far does that apply where you're dealing with ex-ante prevention? You know, the position of someone who is wrongfully convicted of a crime, you know, that's terrible, you know, conviction of the innocent, that's terrible. And we must try and avoid that. And we think we can know a false positive where we see one in that context. But if you are talking about preventive measures which are taken to prevent this particular person or persons from committing a crime you anticipate, but I mean, they've been prevented. So there's no actuality there to kind of see whether they would have done it or not. There can be accidents, which sometimes do happen, where dangerous people are released and you can follow them up and see whether they did commit crimes. And most of them don't. But, the question of how comparable is the theory that we bring to bear on preventive justice to punitive justice, a big question. Because the temptation when you're dealing with preventive justice or preventive measures is that you think in a utilitarian way, and that's not going to be a liberal way or a human rights way. And you, in fact, change the discourse. Instead of talking about justice, you start talking about risk management. As long as the risk management, as risk assessment has been conducted satisfactorily, we're prepared to tolerate, are we, so many false positives? That would be so. Some very interesting questions there about how far these you go with this. And there are different concerns about civil justice where. It's one of the interesting paradox about civil justice is that we're trying to employ new technologies, for online dispute resolution and the like, which will make access to inverted commas justice more convenient, more efficient, and all the rest of it. And I'm all for that. But at the same time, we're trying to prevent disputes arising in the first place. And you can see the good sense in that. Like, as Richard Susskind says, it's better to have a fence at the top of the cliff than an ambulance waiting at the bottom. So prevention's got a lot going for it. But and AI is very much implicated in that. So, right. So we'd have three streams at the conference where there were some very interesting conversations, but they might not have picked up all the questions that need to be asked. So let me quickly just indicate some of the questions that I think are kind of residual questions or which we would still want to pursue, maybe in a fourth stream. And the first thing is that, so much of our thinking is predicated on governance by rules. Governance by rules. Of course, the implication is that humans are the governors. As Lon Fuller says, that law is the enterprise of subjecting human conduct to the governance of rules. And so when Fuller teases out his eight principles of legality, they all follow quite naturally from a commitment by the governors to a regime of governance by rules. Governors say, we're going to govern by rules. Okay, so what does that commit you to? That means, of course, you have to publish rules and all the rest of it. The other desiderata that Fuller identifies under the rubric of legality just come flooding out, no problem, from that commitment to govern by rules. But if you're not governing by rules, if you're governing by rules plus technical measures plus technologies, or in the end, delegating it all to governance by machines, governance by AI, governance by algorithms, what then? What happens to legality? Yeah, that's one question. And a related question is, what about the rule of law? I've put a lot of faith in the rule of law as kind of our last stand. But the rule of law is predicated on rule by rules. And at the moment, of course, we're being reminded about how important the rule of law can be because, the deal is that we follow the rules, but those who make the rules also follow the rules. But it's all about rules and rules. If we're talking about mechanisms of governance, instrumentalities, tools for governance, which aren't rules or principles or standards or anything normative, we're talking about code and architecture and, designing into products and places fixes, which will mean that people can't do things that we want to eliminate. How do those managed environments look in terms of the rule of law? Well, I would say we can't give them, a get out of jail card just because they're not doing it by rules. That would be ridiculous. So, but the logic of this, you have to say the rule of law has to speak not just to governance by rules. It has to speak to governance more generally, whether you're using rules or other means like algorithms, or AI. We have to have a rule of law that stretches across that. And secondly, we have to also get away from the idea the rule of law is only about public rule, public governance. Right? Because so much of what we're interested in here, the tools themselves being developed in the private sector, but also being deployed as governance tools in the private sector. You can't just say that's not covered by the rule of law. So it's both public and private. Then as Joe Rydenberg said, back in 2005, I think, when file sharing was rife, that people online, they just seem to think the rule of law doesn't apply there in cyberspace. Well, this is echoing John Perry Barlow and like libertarians, but that file sharing is fine online, and that trademarks, you don't need to worry about that. So Joel said, well, these internet separatists, we've got to rein them in, and they can't think that they escape the rule of law. So the rule of law has to apply whether the space you're talking about is offline or whether it's online, whether it's in the metaverse. The rule of law has to apply comprehensively, ubiquitously. And it also, finally, the rule of law has to apply as well, whether humans are in the loop, as we expect them to be, where it's governance by rules, or whether they are no longer in the foreground or even in the background in some future where governance by machines is the whole deal. Although I've said we need to put our faith in an extended version of the rule of law, just like Julie Cohen, I think, talks about rule of law version 2.0. This is my version of a modified rule of law, an extended rule of law. I'm not sure in the end whether that is our best bet, and whether we should be thinking instead, as I've said in the closing remarks, about a strategy of good governance more generally. I don't know. But there are questions about that. And there are questions about, there are questions about, as I've said, about the authority of law, which in Andrew and Chris Reed's book, which Andrew mentioned in the introductory remarks there, they have a very effective critique of the idea that the concept of authority, as we understand it in relation to land-based legal systems, can apply in the same way when you're confronted with governance in cyberspace. The authority there has to be more community rooted rather than top down. So authority is already challenged by some of these developments. But before I get to talk about respect for the law, which is what I will do in a minute, I just want you to note the way in which the language that we have, that we're familiar with in a context where governance is by rules and by humans, that language is being translated, I suppose, or transposed lock, stock and barrel to a world of governance by machines. So you talk about trustworthy autonomous systems, trustworthy and autonomous. And now I understand what trustworthy means when it's human to human interactions, and I understand what autonomous means, but I don't think they mean the same thing at all when we talk about that in relation to AI or technologies. And there's a whole ream of things that justice, justification. Think about justification. Lawyers, I was in a seminar the other day where it was considered what's distinctive about legal thinking. And one of the contributors said, well, it's that lawyers are really obsessed with justification. Here's a decision and we need to justify. We have to give good reasons for this. The running debate about explainability or right to explanations in relation to AI decisions seems to me to, it doesn't do justice to the idea of justification, first of all. But, the language of explanation and justification can be carried, the language can be carried across to something we can say, like in an audit of a machine or AI's performance, but it's not the same thing. I've been working for the last 2 years on a book about respect for the law and the reasons we have for being discontent with law, and particularly with, the governance by humans, which is a very imperfect enterprise. When Long Fuller said that law is the enterprise of subjecting human conduct to the governance of rule, should have said it provokes a lot of discontent, and it provokes it especially in communities that are dynamic, where there needs to be some flexibility in the order, and also in communities where you've got intelligent people with their own minds and a plurality of views, because both prudential and moral. Because when you say we want respect for the law, it's a quite striking demand. I mean, what you're saying is you should respect the law simply because it is the law, and you should respect it, your reservations notwithstanding. Well, that's a tough call. That claim might be in trouble anyway, but it's a very tough call. How would people try to to justify making a claim like that, the advocates for respect for the law, well, they usually will say, look at the alternatives. The alternatives are much worse. And you get all sorts of dystopian alternatives then, you know, whether it's the Wild West or, you know, a Hobbesian state of nature, wherever it might be. It's some pretty bad scene that we're in danger of dropping back into if we don't respect the law. But now along comes the possibility, the prospectus for governance by machines, which can do lots of things better than humans. And one thing that they might do better than humans is governance. You know, I mean, it's an awful lot of inconsistency in human decision-making. And machines, you know, driven by algorithms, are going to be far more consistent, predictable. So what about that? I think, interestingly, there's quite a pushback against this. And the pushback is just to the very idea of human governance itself. But, you know, what we should be emphasizing is that law and governance that we want is an essentially human enterprise, imperfect though it is, which is a pretty strange idea. But if I may just connect that up to something that's said all the time about, in Europe anyway, about AI and the regulation of AI, which is that AI has to operate in a way that's human-centric. Now, I'd ask you just to note the distinction between human-centric in the sense that humans remain in control of their governance, that humans are doing the governance, and human-centric in the sense that, well, it governs by any means, but where the machines are involved or AI is involved, it will not do any harm to humans, that is protective or paternalistic, it's benign. That's a quite different deal. And I think one of the big questions, we're talking about questions in relation to AI. One of the questions that's provoked is whether we want to retain human-centric governance where humans are in control of their governance, or whether we are prepared to hand some of it over to machines where our faith is, you know, that the machines will not harm us and they will make a better job of governance. Now, in those circumstances, I think that although we continue to have debates about whether we respect the humans who are doing our governance, whether we respect the machines that are doing the governance, well, we might, but yeah, in some sense, but we don't have reservations about the way the machines are doing things, because even though we might be puzzled or disagree sometimes with things they do, we know that they're basically superior at it and better than we are. Just like, you know, the observers of the famous Go match, a five-match series with AlphaGo. Some of the human observers there were really puzzled at the moves that AlphaGo made. They didn't understand why those moves were made. And yet, it turns out, you know, that these were smarter moves for the AI to be making than the humans realized. Well, okay, so let me just try and get to a winding up here. I don't have time to talk this through, but if you were to ask me, should we have an AI law, yes or no, I would definitely say in the UK we should have an AI law. But I'm not sure that that's our most pressing need. And I certainly don't think that an AI law is going to do anything to restore respect for governance. Rather, I think that an AI law should be put in place against a backcloth where we have already had conversations that have led to two charters, which a charter for good governance, first of all, and a charter for responsible application of technologies. So two charters, I think, that we need to put in place. The charter for good governance is important because this would be kind of substitute for the rule of law, because it would be recognizing that governance extends beyond governance by rules. That the future we have is one in which, you know, rules are not going to be the only tools we use, and machines are going to figure more and more in the way we do our governance. So we need a charter, I think, to put us on the right track with that. The other charter about responsible development and use of technology, well, I mean, we already have, I think, because we already have a responsible movement for responsible research and innovation, which is saying technology shouldn't just do whatever, you know, shouldn't set their own agenda without being responsive to the needs or interests of their particular community. So, okay, that's a good starting point. And responsible technology also needs to be consistent with whatever values are distinctive of a particular community. Well, just like in Europe, we say, you know, that AI has to be consistent, compatible with the European respect for human dignity and human rights. But the crucial thing that we need to add into this charter is that in all communities, regardless of what their distinctive values are, we need to have a guarantee that our technologies are not going to be harmful or compromising of the global commons, of the conditions which all human communities need to have in place before they have any chance of being viable. You know, I mean, Josh Fairfield in his book last year, Runaway Technology, talks about the viability of humans and their communities in I think, quite an evocative way. And I mean, I see this as being partly a matter of our existence conditions. I mean, AI could be a threat to our existence, but it's also a threat to our agency and to know our own interests and to appreciate the interests of others as humans. This is something that we need to have inscribed in the charter, and any law, but an AI law that we're talking about, would need to be made in a way that was fully tuned in to both these charters for good governance and for responsible use of technology, so that a lot of the work would be done by these charters, and we'd just be probably writing in some of the finer terms and conditions for acceptable use of AI, whether for governance or other applications. Okay, that's bringing me to the end, and I mean, in conclusion, I'd say, look, I'm reasonably confident that if I had to put my books on the subject in order, in the way I started off, I could do a reasonable job with that. But if you're talking to me about the challenge of ordering our human communities and of governance within those communities, then that's another ball game altogether. I'm not at all confident about that. And I sense I wouldn't say we're at a crisis point, but I sense that, you know, AI has come onto the scene at a time when governance does face challenges on many different fronts. And I'm not confident that I have the answer to any of that. Thanks, Andrew.
Wow. Well, thank you. I think that was absolutely fantastic. And I've covered sheet. You can't see because I've got my background. But I've covered sheets of paper with notes, as I'm sure many other people have done as well. So we've got about 25 minutes for questions. So as I said, people can drop questions in the chat. I've got one in the chat already that I can pick up in a second. Or, you know, the trouble is you're across a couple of screens and also people have their cameras off. So if you want me to pick you out to ask a question, if you use the raise hand function, that will cause you to come to the top of my screen so I will be able to see you. If you do want to ask any questions, if we could ask you to, you know, start obviously by unmuting yourself, so that's very important, and then to sort of introduce who you are, because we're quite a heterogeneous group, and I'm looking about, I don't know everyone, so, you know, something like, hi, I'm Andrew Murray, and I'm a lecturer at the LSE, I enjoyed the talk, and I would like to ask the following question. So, in fact, while you're all getting your questions in order, I will start by asking the first question, which is, hi, Roger. I'm Andrew Murray, and I'm a lecturer at the LSE, and I really enjoyed that. There was so much in there that I took down notes on. I want to ask the question on your charters at the very end, which I think are very interesting, a really interesting idea. So it seems like a slight provocation. Is the charter a get out to good old fashioned rule of law lawyers, you know, law and fooler, etc., in that we're substituting a law rule with a different kind of rule, in this case, a charter rule. So that's sort of part question 1A, is it just a different type of rule? And then the real meat of the question is, and what would be the benefits of substituting a law rule with a charter rule? I'm slightly concerned a charter rule, and maybe I'm wrong, so do correct me on this, sounds a little bit like ethical principles or values, or a codification of ethical principles or values, something a bit like corporate governance values. And you know, does the AI sector, does the AI industry have enough of a kind of ethical framing to allow the charter to work? So so my question really is, you know, is the charter a substitute for law, and is it would it be a satisfactory substitute for law?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. I mean, first of all, I'm not thinking about this is a charter for good governance. Okay, I'm not thinking about this as just being about or for AI. You know, this would be more general. So, I mean, there's my thinking about this. I have to say, is very preliminary. It's driven by the thought that there are going to be different modalities of governance in play, and we need to have some sort of place where we recognize this, and we don't have kind of distinctions which allow people to argue their way out of constraints which would otherwise, you know, I mean, like I'm saying, this must apply both public and private. Because we know, for example, you know, it seems to be ridiculous that we have so much difficulty making human rights stick in private dealings. You know, we have to perform all sorts of cartwheels to say, well, you know, you can indirectly apply these human rights arguments in private. Yeah, it just seems to me, if you believe in human rights, then you should be able to draw them down directly. And that's one thought. Another thought is that, well, what would be, although some of the elements of good governance would be kind of procedural, I think it would all, there would also be a substantive, well, the headline aspiration there as well. I mean, Joe Raz Joe Raz is an article in the Oxford Journal of Legal Studies where he's rethinking his earlier thoughts on the rule of law. And you know, one of the things he says there is that the governance under the rule of law needs to be in the interest of the governed. And I think you know, that would be something I would be considering to put pretty high up in the charter, that governance should be in the interests of the governed. And you know, there would be that the governors themselves would be in a position, kind of trustees, really, you know, that I know putting people in a position of trustees isn't going to do anything to stop regulatory capture or, you know, corruption. and it could be right that this is a lot of good intentions which don't have bite in practice, you know. Now, that's true. But, I think that, to give it some sort of momentum, you have to have full kind of community involvement in the articulation of this charter. I don't want it to try to do too much, you know, but it must be a statement of general principles that we can all sign up to, you know. It must be so sort of obvious and straightforward in a way. On the other chart, you know, about responsible tech, you know, I can see all sorts of practical problems with this, because although I can say no reasonable person can deny that we should be avoiding things which are going to compromise the global commons, you know, you'd be crazy to say, oh, that's just fine with me. But in practice, we know that, you know, there are many sort of game players who are quite happy for other people to respect the global commons while they go on abusing it. You know, again, I mean, it's all very well trying to get this up and running within a particular favorable single community. Another matter altogether where, you know, you've got lots of communities doing this and competing with one another. But,
I think we'll need to have you back to do a seminar on Charter for Good Governance as well. That's for another date. Okay, so I'm going to pick out a question that's been sent in the chat. So, this is from Gizem, who says, thank you very much for the talk. I would like to ask, what do you think about the state's approach to the related draft AI Act for the European Union? So what do you think of the draft AI Act as a model?
Yeah. Well, Andrew, I can't actually see the questions in my chat.
Yeah, that's okay. This has been sent to me directly. So that's
okay. So what's my take on the AI? Draft AI. This is a good example, isn't it, of an attempt to try to as I said earlier on, address the standard conundrum that we have in law and technology, which is that we have to manage the risks. You know, I mean, it's so much of what you read in the draft is about, you know, classifying risks and calibrating the kind of precautions that are taken to the level of risk that you think the application involves. I mean, no doubt there's endless room for arguments about whether they've got the right things in the, there's absolutely no way any of this should ever be, you know, AI should ever be used for these three or four things, and, you know, what you think is high risk and so on. It's a model of risk regulation by risk management, risk assessment, risk communication. But at the same time, you know, that's all got to be moderated in a way that doesn't stifle innovation, because, you know, the EU is as keen as anybody to get whatever advantages and benefits there are from AI. So it doesn't want to, you know, I mean, we're all involved in that kind of balancing. So the way the EU eventually positions itself, which I'm sure, like with the GDPR, is going to involve a horrendously complex bit of law. You know, it's not going to be very readable or accessible, I don't think. But it's, but it is what it is. It doesn't really deal very much with the questions that I was saying are, you know, are tricky about the use of AI for governance purposes. I mean, it's in there in a bit, but it's not in the foreground. If you had to put the draft AI Act on my bookshelf, it would be in that part where we're talking about laying down the regulatory framework for the applications of AI. It wouldn't be about governance by AI. And of course, I know it's inevitable, but I don't like the fact that the military applications of AI are excluded from, I'm saying you can't give people a free pass on AI just by going online or in the private sector. I know that the Act would have no prospects if it tried to do this, but, you know, I can't accept that. The AI in military applications, if I thought it did contribute to peace and well-being and our continuing human existence, I may be more in favor, but it seems to me to be just, you know, yeah, just the opposite. Things are going to go wrong there, and that could be catastrophic. So, I think we all need to do things that are sensible about that. But interestingly enough, governance, I think, in the context of the AI Act, is sort of something that the oversight board or whatever it will be engaged in. And I very much like I'm very keen on the idea, I think you know, Andrew, that we should try to gather together the governance intelligence that we have in relation to these new technologies. So if the EU is able to have some sort of hub that is able to coordinate and gather our intelligence about this, that's good. But I do, you know, I'm not a great critic of this. I mean, when I was, as you know, on the Working Party on Machine Learning, the Royal Society, the view in the UK, partly accidentally, I think, was that we'd got a conversation going on about data protection, and we could really subsume AI under the data protection laws. And, you know, in Europe, they've decided not to do that, although obviously there are provisions in the GDPR which engage AI. We're having a separate shot at this in the EU. And I would commend that. So, there's a question just come up on my chat here, which is quite a long one. Can I just have a quick look at?
You have a look at that for a second. You have a look at that question, and I'll introduce it as well. And just to say, just picking up on one or two themes in your answer there, Roger, I think one thing that's really, I think, important is there's something to be said around emerging technologies, funnily enough, for having grey hair in the room.
Right.
Because I find, and I think this is something you're alluding to there, I find a lot of the challenges with emerging technologies, whether it be decentered technologies, whether it be AI or whether it be metaverse or whatever, people talk about them as if they're new,
Right.
But those of us who've got a little bit of grey hair, or in my case, had grey hair once upon a time, you know, we can remember debates first time around about similar technology. They're not the same, but no. The governance questions are often quite similar. Around new and emergent technologies, and sometimes we're in a hurry, I think, to throw out what we knew before because of the sort of the challenge of the new, so to speak. So
I think that's right. I mean, I think there are some huge gaps in our knowledge, but
yeah,
I think we perhaps do know more than we realize we know, and it's a crime.
It is.
We don't consolidate what we do know.
I think that's very important. So the large question, which hopefully you've had a chance to look at now, comes from one of my fantastic colleagues, Dr. Julia Gentile, who's one of our members of the LTS group. And she has typed out at great length a very interesting question, which I think has been put to everyone, so everyone can see it. So I'm not going to repeat it all word for word, but I mean, she's basically asking about the sort of procedural and substantive values in the AI charter, would the application of the rule of law in the field of AI resolve in the horizontal application of fundamental rights? So Julie, you can unmute yourself if I get this wrong. I think the question is this a way to get a kind of horizontal rights framework? Oh, I see Julie is coming on. So maybe you want to explain it better than I can, Julie. I'll pass
over. Yes, of course. Thanks so much, Roger, for the talk. This was fascinating. And in fact, my question is linked to a comment that you made at a certain point regarding the extension of the rule of law, so to say, in the private sphere. And I was just wondering, how would that work? Would that basically correspond to a horizontal application of fundamental rights, or do you have in mind something else?
Well, no, I mean, in the traditional debate about the rule of law, we're kind of stuck between those who are proceduralists and think that's as far as we should go, and those who want to bring in some substantive component, usually sort of human rights. My understanding is that the proceduralists are worried that, well, I think the procedural element of the rule of law is so undemanding that we can get pretty much everyone to sign up to it. Whereas once you start glossing it with substantive provisions, even if it's human rights, which almost everyone has signed up to again, there are problems, because then there are different kind of versions of the rule. It gets fragmented. Well, I mean, I don't really buy that, but I think the rule of law in a minimal procedural version is better than nothing, but it's not much better than nothing. I'm really with the substantivists, you know, on that question, and the challenge for the substantivists the challenge for the substantivists is to show how they can justify the substance that they want to put into the rule of law. Nearly everyone signs up to human rights, or nearly everyone signs up to some principles which are in international law, you know, which are kind of just Kogan's, you know, but that's not good enough. As I intimated in the talk there, my line is that there are some things which we cannot possibly deny are valuable for us, because they are the preconditions, they are kind of the critical infrastructure for our human communities. They don't dictate the kind of human community that we as a group will develop or articulate. But we can't even get off the ground unless these conditions are in place, you know. Environmentalists, so all the time have been arguing, you know, pleading the precautionary principle. I think we should understand that it's not a debate within the human community. It's about the protection of the preconditions for human community. And again, you know, the kind of concerns that you've got from Julie Cohen and Shoshana Zuboff about the way agency might compromise. This is, you know, high intensive surveillance inhibits a sense of who we are, what we want to do, you know, and this is catastrophic. And it's not everything. So it's just the preconditions, and they're generic, you know, like any infrastructure. So my vision is of communities then building around their own sense of what's valuable. So you have a plurality of human communities. I mean, this isn't a recipe for homogeneity. It's saying there's going to be a plurality of human communities, each of which has a sort of constitutional level, its own statement of its fundamental values and aspirations, but all of which draw on these preconditions for their viability. So we're all in the same boat with that. And so I think those conditions have to be drawn down, must be available directly, and you know, vertically, if you like. Also, if you think in a private law dispute way, you know, the relationship is horizontal, that there's an activity going on, which, you know, like at Facebook or wherever, you know, you think, well, what these people are doing is actually compromising the global commons, then that should be an argument that's available. Yeah. So the rule of law with that substantive dimension in it would be available in both vertical and horizontal relationships. Yeah. Yeah, it would. As I say, just like encroaching on the private sector is, I mean, I know that this is a huge pushback and that this is kind of idealistic view of things, but yeah, that would be the thinking behind this, yeah.
I have one other question from the chat, so I shall take the opportunity to ask this. So this comes from Prakar, and it's a student perspective saying, This area moves very quickly. A few years back, we were listening about AI, then blockchain, then crypto, and now it's Web 3.0 and decentralized finance. And also, you could probably add to that the idea of metaverse. So where should a student who's interested in this begin their law and technology journey? Where would you read into this, Roger?
I'd say read Law 3.0, my little... That's I think we should be introducing students to law and technology in the first year of undergraduate programs. I think an introduction to law should be along those lines, it's not technology specific, it's just getting a kind of the bigger picture in the background. I mean, there are people who think that, you know, our law schools should be training lawyers to be data scientists because, you know, that is so much in the spotlight at the moment. But if you go back to where I started with biotech, no one was suggesting there, I think, that we should be trained. We had to understand enough about genetics to get into the conversation. But I think if you put all your eggs in one particular technology, you're going to find that, okay, you are the expert on that, but the spotlight's moved on to something else. And I don't know what, I mean, again, I don't want to say in a sort of imperialistic way, this is the only way you should do this. But I think, yeah, it may be that we'd have to make a choice as to whether we try and retain some sort of general sense of this field and take an interest as far as we can in whatever happens to be in the spotlight at the time. Or whether we are really going to invest and drill down into a particular technology. I mean, there are people I work with down in Bournemouth who are very interested in 3D printing. Mm. And I mean, basically from an IP perspective. Now, you know, it may be that the interest in 3D printing fizzles out. I don't know. I mean, well, I wouldn't say it's ever been quite in the same, had the same attention as blockchain or AI, you know. But it's going back again to what you were saying about the gray hair, Andrew. I mean, with the metaverse, I'm sure we're going to, I mean, you know, Law Innovation Technology, the journal, we've already had submissions on how you apply different bits of law to the metaverse, mm-hmm. you know, predictably. And I'm sure there's going to be loads of conversations about that. Mm-hmm. But for those of us who remember back in the early days was like Second Life and, you know, when you cross the boundary into the metaverse, is that any different to what was going on in Second Life? Or, you know, are these puzzles just going to replay?
Yeah, I suspect so. I mean, I remember when Second Life came out, one of the first questions I was asked by someone was if we employ someone to to work in our virtual showroom in Second Life? Do we have to pay them the national minimum wage for the UK? and that question will no doubt come up again or something like it. I think we've got time for one last question. Pascal has his hand up. So, Pascal.
Hi, thank you so much. My name is Pascal. I'm an assistant professor of law at the University of Ottawa in Canada, and I'm currently based in Paris. And my interest in these topics is mostly as a labor employment lawyer, but I really enjoyed your sort of mapping of the different attitudes we might take across fields to these questions. And I wanted to ask a question that's been partly asked by Professor Murray, so I'll emphasize the part that hasn't been touched on, which is about historical novelty. And it struck me that, the three strands that you mentioned, so the first and the third, might want to ally against the second in precisely arguing that we shouldn't overemphasize the historical novelty of these issues. And so this would be the first strand's sort of impetus. And the third strand would add that overemphasizing historical novelty might lead us to a sense of false necessity. So overemphasizing the extent to which, for instance, these digital technologies are inherently discriminatory or inherently authoritarian in the workplace, such that there's a logic that governs them that cannot be overturned. And there's a sense of powerlessness and dystopia that might be associated with that. So this is the part of the question that I think hasn't been touched on by Professor Murray. The idea that not thinking too much that this is novel might have the added benefit of avoiding false necessity. Do you agree with that? Does that speak to you? Is that an attitude that you would want to keep from, I guess, the first strand, or sort of to keep space for agency for policymakers to be able to govern and do something as opposed to being defeated by surveillance capitalism and its evil nature? So thank you so much.
Nice. Very interesting. Thanks, Pascal. It's a very interesting question. I don't know quite where to begin or end with that question. I mean, you're right that, I don't think it's just from the first strand, but there will be people who will say, just hang on a minute, how novel is this? But certainly the impulse to jump in with regulation and to fail is that's something to be careful about. And I can see how this could be a hostage to fortune, because the proponents of these technologies would welcome regulators who wanted to go slowly with it and, not going to over-regulate, because I'm a bit nervous about that. But of course, one of the big dilemmas is what we know about the right time if we are going to regulate, right time to do so. I mean, like in the UK, we've been very slow to regulate in the crypto world. The Financial Conduct Authority has been monitoring this for a long, long time. And in other jurisdictions, as you know, the action's been far more prompt, and they knew what they wanted to do. There's another strand in what you're asking is whether in the end it's better to have sort of self-governance taking care of things, rather than trying to have central, heavy top-down governance, which takes on too much and can't do the job properly, because all sorts of lessons aren't there of the way in which communities can self-govern in perfectly satisfactory ways and do better in the end than if the state tries to impose an overreach on its regulatory efforts. I don't know. I mean, again, I was in a workshop the other day where there were views about Brussels taking on far too, they always tries to take on far too much, and be better if you let self-governance take care of things a bit. But I'm sorry, that's a pretty inadequate answer to a question that, just like good governance, that's a challenging one.
I think I'm going to add two things to close. One, anyone who's interested in whether or not self-governance is likely to succeed for AI technology, there's a really good paper by Julia Black and Andrew Murray a couple of years ago talking about the risks of the failure of self-governance. I recommend the European Journal of Law and Technology. A little plug for myself and for Julia. And I think that brings us to the end. We've actually now gone 2 minutes over our time. So thank you all, those of you who have stayed till the end. And I think let's say thank you very much to Professor Brownsword. You know, if you can indicate your appreciation in the way that Martin Husovec and others are showing, we can kind of say thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew.
I think that was absolutely fantastic. To remind people that the series will continue now on Tuesday, the 8th of March, with Jeremy Sadams-Prassel looking at What If Your Boss Was an Algorithm, AI in the Workplace, which hopefully will be in a hybrid format. So those of you who are LSE staff and students will hopefully be able to attend in the moot courtroom. Everyone else will be able to join us in this format by Zoom. There will be registration details going up soon. They're not quite there yet, but in the next week or so, hopefully, we'll be contacting people with how to join for that. So thank you all very much for joining us tonight. And thank you, Roger. Thank you all.
Thanks, Andrew. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.